Welcome to our Friday Five Live podcast hosted by Meg Foster. Meg has spent 20 years in higher education focused on student success initiatives and working in areas such as orientation, faculty development, online learning, student leadership, and first-year initiatives.
Welcome, everybody. Happy Friday. If you're just joining us, we kicked off with some really important discussions about wildlife sightings in your neck of the woods, which seems appropriate for the first full day of summer. So let us know, if you've where you're listening from today, and if you've had any exciting bears, cougars, whale sightings, or even just a cute frog or turtle. We'll take those too. Crystal's putting the PowerPoint slides in our chat, so you've got that available to you. And just as a reminder that our podcast is available on all major podcasting platforms. So if you want to share this with folks, there's lots of different ways for you to go about doing that. We do love the chat, Emily, in this podcast. So if you're listening in today, please use the chat. Just make sure you've selected everyone from the dropdown so we can all see your questions or comments. And while I prepared some questions for Emily, we love to hear from you all as well. So don't hesitate to put your questions in the chat. And fear not, Emily, my job is to pay attention to that and then weave it into our conversation today. So I want to welcome Emily. Here is her beautiful headshot. Emily Bauer is a just an incredible person who I got to know several years ago when she was still working in student affairs. She does have her doctorate from Northeastern University, where she's researched the topic of mental health literacy and its application with non-clinicians. A lot of those are us, right? A lot of student affairs staff probably on the call today. Emily's worked in higher education and is now taking that work, and she's going to share with us what she's currently doing and how it all kind of weaves together as we have this conversation about understanding trauma-informed care and how we can really apply that to build healthier communities at our colleges and universities. So with that, I'm going to pause because I really want Emily to kind of share with us how you got to this point.
Yes, thank you, Meg. So I have 20 years of experience in higher education and love working with college students on college campuses. My work mainly focused on orientation, student engagement, and student success. So I've worked with innovative educators for many years, and I'm so glad that all of you are here today. During my journey in student affairs, I really became aware that mental health concerns were creeping up there. And I felt like as student affairs practitioners, we really didn't have a lot of direction, or perhaps we were under the impression or told that we weren't really allowed to talk about it because it was a liability. So thus, it set off my journey of looking into mental health and then finding trauma-informed care. So obviously, we know that counseling centers are overwhelmed, and it's not good logic to think that a staff of X number of counselors can handle a whole campus, no matter what campus you're on at this point. And we know that these issues are increasing. And so during my journey, I was actually on a campus, San Jose State, shout out to the CSU, who trained about 20 of us as mental health first aid instructors. And at the time, that was a 12-hour training. And then moved to eight. I spent about 8 years as a mental health first aid instructor volunteering. And what I saw during that time was, one, the application of mental health literacy, which is a World Health Organization term that is used to measure really the mental health of a community. It looks at signs and symptoms of things that are coming up, helping people understand when something might be coming up for them, lowering stigma and increasing help seeking. And that if we can do that on college campuses, that's going to help the overall mental health. I set about to do an action research project on my dissertation, where I looked at applying mental health literacy to student affairs and what that could look like and what a specific institution, how they would do that. And surprise, my main key finding, one of them, is that trauma-informed care is really something we should be focusing on in higher education. And so 2 years ago, I made the decision to leave higher education And I now work for a behavioral health agency in Arizona that I consider really cutting edge. And everything that we do and all of our pillars are trauma-informed care. So I've really been able to do some work around risk, but to work with a lot of trauma and just kind of understand some approaches that work. And the great thing is ways that you can help people work through this and build skills and be resilient. And so I really believe in it. And I'm super glad to be talking about it today. The other thing that comes up for me, now I work with the under 18 population, the amount of suicide ideation and crisis that is happening with our youth is just increasing, and it's going to come to your campus. And we need to be prepared and be able to have some things and some understanding in place. And my belief is, with the proper lens, we can meet students here where they're starting to have some things coming up and help them to build some skills around that so that hopefully a crisis can be avoided in the first place. And that's really my belief around mental health on campus. I do believe that some past policies around mental health weren't helpful and they weren't applied through a trauma-informed lens. And so I really want to help campuses talk through those things and what we can or should do for students and their safety.
And so wise. We talk a lot in this podcast about kind of doing that important work of looking at what is happening in K-12, right, to inform us preparing for the students that are going to be coming to our campus. And of course, you know, this podcast kicked off during COVID, and you know, I certainly think we're going to continue to see those ripple effects for a very long time of that disruption of education. But, you know, you're bringing up this increased amount of suicidal ideation in, you know, teens and younger people, and that those will be students enrolling on our college campuses. And how can we be prepared to best support?
Yes. And I think to me, there's so much resistance to, I am not a licensed therapist, or you are not a licensed therapist, that you shouldn't be talking about suicide or mental health. And I think it's having those conversations and understanding protocols and policies on campus, but honestly, moving away from thinking about liability on behalf of the university to applying this lens of care and how can we work with students rather than almost shunning them for having had suicidal ideations. And we all know about past policies like removing students from campus. Mm-hmm. We do know that suicide for most people is a limited time crisis and that they can recover and be okay.
And I think you bring up, and I know I'm going to advance our slides here so that we can look at our list of prepared questions, but because we're going to get to this idea. I think there is a lot of, you know, we're just seeing a lot and hearing a lot about faculty and staff, you know, they're it's been an exhausting 4 years. This increasing, you know, you need to be aware and be mentally healthy yourself so you can also support students. And so that's really complicated. And I know we're going to kind of peel back some of those layers in our conversation today. So as I mentioned, Crystal has put the PowerPoint link in, and you'll see some resources here at the bottom that Emily's going to refer to. I want to call out particularly her website and then also The Body Keeps the Score, which is a book that she's going to share some about with us today. So I guess just to kind of get us started, like, what is this idea of trauma-informed care? I'd be kind of curious, you know, if you're somebody who's well-informed about this on our call, let us know that. Or if you're somebody who's listening in and this is brand new, we'd love to hear that as well. And why, you know, you've kind of touched on this a little bit, but what the importance of this in the context of our world of higher ed?
Yeah, definitely. So when I was thinking about a definition for this in higher education, it really is having a caring and individualized approach that acknowledges student experience and establishes some main principles. And so you'll see different, like there's four principles, there's five, there's six. These are the ones that I have honed in on. But one is safety, realizing that there's a trauma response in people, and that's a lot of times because safety hasn't been there for them. They've been through some adverse things. So safety is the very first thing we need to establish. Trust, choice. A lot of people who've gone through trauma during those instances didn't have a say, didn't have their own agency. Collaboration. How are we working with you to help you through this and talk with you and what that looks like? Empowerment to grow, and then cultural awareness. So how is that lens impacting what's going on? So for me, the key concepts of trauma-informed care, and again, I've been a social worker and a supervisor of social workers for the past 2 years. The first is strengths-based. So it needs to have a positive focus and be strengths-based. I do believe that in higher education, sometimes we can fall victim to deficit thinking. So even thinking about, hey, I got this new position open in my office and I have 100 applicants, I'm just going to start taking people out that don't have X, you know, or perhaps like, well, you never worked at this type of institution. And then you end up with the person who has already done the job somewhere else and leaves in a year because it's not challenging them. And so that's the kind of like, let's look at strengths-based. Every meeting we have with families in my agency starts with strengths. Even if the kid's out of home, what is going well for the student and what are their strengths, and helping the families to see that. I think that's really important. And then a really big thing is understanding the impact of trauma on the brain and the nervous system. So what we're seeing with trauma, this is a nervous system reaction. This is the brain telling the body it's not safe. And perhaps that's not true, but to that individual, it feels like it is. And acknowledging that. And that this has an impact on quality of life and behavior. So when we're seeing these things through a BIT team or, you know, a student that kind of had an outburst, this could be what's going on. And instead of thinking the student has a problem or they are a problem, how can we kind of partner with them to look at what's going on for them and see if we can help them grow some skills to help them overcome that? So it's really fight or flight is activated. And I know from working with parents of kids that have outbursts and things like that, that sometimes you want to have a rational conversation with someone when they're in that space, and you can't. Their brain is down here, and they're not in that, accessing the part of the brain where you can have a rational discussion. And so I think really understanding that this is tied to behavior, it's tied to emotions. And when you're seeing something that seems really heightened and it doesn't seem to be matching with what's going on, that's something to pay attention to that could be trauma. And the great news is that this can be successfully addressed through helping with skills. So even stress management, basic stress management, things that we know that help for everyone for self-care. I'm a volunteer crisis counselor for a suicide lifeline. And the main work we do is to help them think through, how can I support myself right now? What are the things that help me feel good when I'm stressed, feeling down, et cetera? And really being able to help them talk through, this is what helps me. This is how I regulate my emotions. And that is something that I don't think we've thought about in higher education. Or we felt like, well, if you don't have your emotions in check, why are you in college? Well, guess what? If you're going to exclude everyone who's dealing with that, you're not going to meet your enrollment target.
Right. No, yeah. I do think that we kind of have assumed, well, you're coming to college and you're an adult, right? And so therefore you already have all these skills around. And, you know, and we know that the space that you're in working with students, younger students now, I mean, we probably can't do enough social emotional instruction in our school systems.
And I want to point out, as you said earlier, in the K-12 system, they've been looking at this for a while. And so social emotional development is part of an IEP process in K-12. And I feel like the sentiment in the university is, well, you got to have your shit together when you get here. And starting to understand that some people don't, and that it's okay. And it's not a bad personality. It can grow. There is hope. And it's just kind of understanding and being gracious about that. One of the big protective factors when you're looking at trauma. So first of all, backing up, K-12 system uses something called ACEs. And so that's measuring adverse childhood experiences. And they kind of have some qualitative and quantitative things they do around that to measure that. But really statistically, the higher number of adverse childhood experiences, there can be some very negative impacts on that person's life and their physical health over time. And so it's really working to counteract that and understanding the impact that trauma has had on them. I work with some kids who their basic needs weren't taken care of when they were a baby. And it comes out in some interesting ways now that they're older and that there is hope. And if you take away one thing today, the real key to this is connection to other people. I can't tell you how many kids I work with right now who have decided to be online for school, whether it's from bullying, because it's easier for them, et cetera. With the pandemic, that opened that path up, but there's a lot of people out there who aren't feeling connected to each other. And I would say this next generation is, you know, they're talking on the screen, they're sending voice texts, they're not, you know, talking through Discord or Fortnite, those kinds of things. And that this idea of how do we help them connect to each other in a meaningful way is more important than it's ever been. I also think that with applying a trauma-informed lens, that this is going to help with retention. It's going to help with success, because if we can help get people out of fight or flight and really engage their brain in learning and engaging in campus, that's going to be amazing for everyone. So I think it's a really awesome opportunity.
Yeah, that's a really, as we're talking about, you know, how do we frame things not from a strength-based, right? If we look at this as, okay, what are the opportunities? And there's some interesting, as I'm sitting here listening, I'm thinking about the university, one of the University of Wisconsin institutions, like in their system, kind of did this in like 2021, where they said, okay, institutionally, we have gone through this, COVID has really impacted. It's a very diverse campus where there was a lot of, you know, COVID loss, and how can we better support one another? And so really they are looking at it from an institutional perspective, mm-hmm. and kind of using trauma-informed care to shape their campus culture and to talk about it from that opportunity perspective, because it has really transformed how they're able to support the entire institution, not just the students, right? But the mm-hmm. faculty and staff as well, and the larger community that they're a part of. Because I do think there's such a, you know, it's funny, I got to attend, our community college system began to do some work around trauma-informed care instruction for professional development, literally like 6 weeks before the pandemic hit. So I went, my last professional development in real life in 2020 was trauma-informed care. I spent 2 days learning, and it was so rich and so fascinating. And then, you know, to have the pandemic that we then, to have that knowledge base, right? Mm-hmm. Moving into the pandemic was, I think, very helpful. But some of the excitement around that in our system was, what would that look, how can we transform not only our institutions, but then the ripple effect of what happens in our communities, right? If we're the folks educating the future teachers and nurses and police officers and firefighters, I mean, just all these people, I mean, I'm thinking of helping, mm-hmm. but it, you know, and they leave and go into our communities to work with this knowledge about what are ACEs and what does trauma-informed care look like? How might that kind of, and I know this sounds a little idealistic, but what could be the very positive ramifications around our community development? And mm-hmm. and to me, that seems even more profound, given that we've just lived through this pandemic where people are now more isolated, right? And the loneliness and the Surgeon General warnings around social media and children and the most anxious generation.
Yes. Yeah. There's so many cool things that can happen. And it's just kind of taking a step back and saying, how can I apply this myself? What are some things that we can all be doing? So I chose to look through the lens of mental health literacy, which is focusing on educating people on what are signs and symptoms and how can we lower the stigma and really help people seek help when they need it and they're ready. Yeah. And so that's been really powerful to me. And as a mental health first aid instructor, that is the theory behind mental health first aid. And it comes from Australia. And I found that that's really powerful combined with trauma-informed care.
That's great.
Yeah. I wanted to point out the book that's down here, everyone. It's called The Body Keeps the Score. You may be aware of it if you're interested in this, but this is really a top researcher around trauma who wrote a book called The Body Keeps the Score. And it really has some great information and things to consider. I wanted to read something that kind of helps you think about what's in there. It states that trauma changes the brain, causing toxic behaviors such as anxiety, depression, rebellion, submissiveness, etc. These rob traumatized people of their self-esteem and prevent them from living everyday life. And he did in the book, he did some work with veterans with PTSD and things like that. But it really is a good way to look at how is this mind-body connection working around that fight or flight or around trauma and the things that come up for people.
And Emily, as I'm thinking about who, we've talked about who are these K-12 students, right, who are going to be eventually enrolling in our institutions. But we also know that there's this record-setting number of Americans, right, who are adults who have some college, no degree. This has been all over kind of the higher ed news in the last couple of weeks. And so if we're re-enrolling these adult students at our institutions, which I hope is a goal, that, we want these folks to earn certificates, earn credentials, right, have those opportunities. Then, in my mind, that naturally opens us up to serving more students who potentially have had additional traumas because, they're adults, they've lived longer, et cetera, et cetera. So,
Yeah. And what my
that's a
take when
concern.
I'm working with people nowadays is everyone's had trauma. After going through COVID, everyone has some trauma somewhere. And it's okay to just maybe assume that everyone has their triggers and everyone has some things that are hard for them and just start at that base level.
Well, examples of any kind of practice as you're thinking about policy. I mean, you've mentioned, yes, institutions have had, policies, right, that maybe are ones that serve to say keep the institution safe, but aren't necessarily student focused. So thinking about policies, even thinking about syllabus statements, right, or I'm academic advisor and I'm working with students. I mean, just all of those places. Are there some resources you would suggest, some things that you would encourage us to really think about or consider?
Sure. Yeah. So a couple of things around policies. I think that we need to look at access to resources. So when I did a legal review for my research and my dissertation around this topic, I really found cases that were actually not about the institution didn't save my child from dying, but actually the institution kicked my child off campus. They lost their housing, they lost their counselor, and then they died. And that's really, I think there is this old school notion of, oh, we can't talk about it. But I believe that there is a way to caringly talk about it without being a licensed therapist. And obviously, there's going to be crisis protocol. It's not going to be on you to decide if someone's going inpatient or if there needs to be a next step. There just needs to be a clear handoff and some awareness of what that means. And it doesn't mean you can't ask someone if they're thinking of suicide. Because again, when are they going to get in to see the counselor? And if this is coming up right now, someone needs to talk to them right now. And I know that there are crisis protocols on campus, but I really do think that just being a caring human and listening. I was with one of my teenagers last night who was having SI, and just being able to get there and validate and talk through safety planning. And again, every campus is going to be different. If it comes to having active SI, that might be the crisis that you then pass it on, but not being afraid to have those conversations. So, Meg, if you have a student in class every day and you notice a real big shift in their personality and they're coming in slovenly and they're not seeming to care, that's someone you can sit with and say, I care. what's going on here, and have that caring conversation and listen and validate what they're going through and help them to find some skills around.
You know, it makes you think about like the educational piece for us as professionals, right, in our communities, because it's scary. I mean, it is as somebody who, you know, has sat through many suicide prevention trainings as part of my profession. I am not a licensed counselor, and I will tell you that scares me, right? Like, these are intimidating things to learn about, because we understand the seriousness of repercussion, and I think people want to do it right, right? Like, you know, but one of the things that I think is in our communities, if we keep bringing it up, you know, that here's how to be a mental health responder, you know, we have these protocols, you're not the only person, right? And I know that's hard. I mean, we have a lot of part-time employees at institutions. I mean, I'm just thinking realistically, right, about, you know, if you're at a community college, you're serving the community. And there can be, and some of us are at institutions that are really well-resourced as far as mental health goes. As I've said on this podcast before, our Virginia Community College system, there are no counseling centers at any of the community colleges. So we are really reliant on those relationships that we've formed with community partners. So these are complex conversations. And I think that piece of Amanda mentioned, you know, she's going to be doing trauma-informed care at her institution, some training this fall, and she's excited about that. But just that we probably all need the refresher.
Yes. Yeah. So definitely training. I believe ultimately in a safety, a spider web, all of deputizing the campus in a positive way of here's, and if you don't feel comfortable, it's okay. And we can consult. But what I can tell you from teaching mental health first aid is equipping people with that information and practicing scenarios. You can hear, yes, I'm thinking of suicide, and handle it, and it's okay. And then you can help get them to whatever the next step is. Mm-hmm. And I think having that weight off of you and not thinking I'm ultimately responsible for whether this person lives or dies. Even what I do with my staff, the student I worked with last night came very close to me calling for evaluation to see if they needed to go inpatient. Mm-hmm. And again, that's not on me. And I'm a manager, right? We have hospitals, we have ERs, we have places that you can go to get that's not on you. Right. And hopefully campuses have either a virtual call-in system that they've set up for students, or they have some kind of way to reach counseling after hours, or whatever local. For us, we have a company that's contracted for our county that will come out to do that assessment and then try to do the paperwork on the back end if someone is going to go inpatient and take them to the hospital.
Well, I want to circle back to one of our earlier questions that I kind of skipped, and you started to address this, that, you know, if you have a student who comes in to class and like there's a very clear kind of change in demeanor, they're no longer showering. I mean, and we've probably all taught these students before. But what are some other signs that, you know, we might need to pay attention to?
Definitely. So I wanted to share something else from the book that I think kind of helps picture that. It says traumatized children share three characteristics. So a persistent dysregulation pattern. So if someone's kind of hot, maybe has some anger or shuts down, attention and concentration problems, and attunement difficulty with self and others. So here we have social connection issues, not coming off well, having potential memory issues, dissociating, and then having that dysregulation pattern, which is what we work with a lot in our youth, is how are we helping you to realize you're being dysregulated and then build a toolkit for how you deal with that when that's coming up. So what this could look like, again, it's related to fight or flight or freeze. And a lot of the times people just aren't aware that this could be a different way. For a lot of these people, this is how they've been in their life. And so having that awareness and compassion, but one kind of path could be hyper arousal or vigilance. So I have a history of not feeling safe. I don't feel safe. I'm going to keep complaining about this feeling bad or that feeling bad. and to take them seriously about that and help them talk through it. Dissociation or memory loss. So some people choose to dissociate from it, but that kind of messes with memory or with some of the memory things you're seeing to be able to function as a student. There could also be physical or somatic symptoms. So a lot of complaining about headaches, GI issues, physical pain, and kind of circling back and realizing that these might be related to an emotional and mental health issue rather than just a physical issue going on. And the last one is just this, you know, not really being able to communicate in a healthy way and having some social skill issues, social cue issues as well. So those to me are big signs. And I think right now, just understanding the amount of stress and trauma that people are coming with to campus around increased violence, you know, am I safe on campus? Feeling targeted due to identity. So these are things that you might hear people talking about that trigger you to, oh, there might be some trauma here that they're trying to talk through. The current political climate is very, you know, just aggressive towards people. Dangers on social media, having been in an unhealthy relationship where you're not treated well. A growing concern I have is trafficking. I have a lot of teenagers online who are talking to men that they shouldn't be and that they don't realize are predators. And I've learned that eventually these people, they still live at home. They don't have to be kidnapped and taken. They still live at home and go to school and they're being trafficked. And then a lot of students share with me that they're afraid to go to the store or large places of gathering like a concert because of violence and things and the pandemic. They're very afraid to even go out in public. And that if they're talking about these things, it's a good time to just listen. Even letting them be heard and validating their experience can be super helpful. And you don't have to fix it. You're not the fixer of the trauma. And that takes some weight off.
Yeah, that's a really powerful, you're not the fixer, I think, as the listener and as the person demonstrating care, and then I can connect you to resources. You know, there's been some chatter here. I want to make sure we get that. You know, and Raymond has some good questions about, you know, are educational institutions really set up to assist students? Can they even properly refer them to the right places? And I, you know, it's funny, my dad is a former college administrator and he's 84 years old. And we have a lot of conversations about, particularly in our community college systems, that I think institutions really have become, we have to become places where we're providing social services in a way that, you know, early in my father's career would never have happened, never have happened. In our last podcast, I got to talk with two amazing folks who are doing really important work around basic needs and security, which, Emily, I feel like so, I don't do this intentionally, but sometimes the topics begin to weave together. 'Cause I do feel like we're probably seeing students who are, you know, basic needs. And this is not a small percentage of our college population. I think that's one of the things I keep feeling like, I probably get on my little soapbox with my drum to beat, but college students are not who college students were 25 years ago, right? They're not 18-year-old students coming to us from high school who are well-resourced. That is not the reality. College doesn't cost what it cost 25 years, right? I mean, we are seeing some 40% of students showing up who don't have, like, are struggling to meet basic needs. And so when we layer that with trauma.
And that is a trauma in itself.
And so Raymond's question is an interesting one, because I think my counter to that is we need an educated workforce, right? I mean, we need folks who have all these different levels of degrees that we provide at our institutions. And we want that. We want our communities to be places where folks can make a living wage and have, or more than a living wage, you know, have a good career and a good life. And So interesting topics that are getting brought up here. So Amanda has mentioned that she is QPR certified, question, persuade, refer, which is something I've not heard of before. So kind of like a play on CPR, I guess, if you're a
Yeah,
QPR.
and it's really good at talking about suicide ideation and when do you refer out. And I think one of the main keys here too is that we're not the expert, we're a safety web. And partnering with your counseling center, I think the old notion of everyone's just going to have counseling appointments, they can't handle that. And they know that. They're just trying to handle all the acute cases that are popping up. And so, are there things that get at bigger populations, such as trainings? So, I've partnered in the past with counselors because, again, people need that counseling label to think this is okay. I can do this too. We can talk about this because there's a counselor in the room. And I think people really feel that sometimes, and that's okay too. It is scary to talk about. It's scary stuff. And I think a lot of people are going to have fear. But again, you're not responsible for that person. You're responsible to them. And you are not the fixer. You can empower them, show them some skills, even starting with basic stress management to calm that nervous system, physical regulation. What are you doing that's enjoyable? What are you doing that brings you social connection? Or that regulates your emotions, such as yoga, meditation, gets you in your body and not dissociating. Those are the things that are really helpful. And those are the things that they kind of get into in the back of the body keeps the score.
Well, and that, so, as we think about policies on our campuses and education on our campuses. And I mean, I think, and I know sometimes my own students say I sound like a broken record, but reminding, Dawn's mentioned having a quiet room on campus. I'm constantly reminding students about some basic things they need to do. They have to sleep. Like, you cannot be a mentally healthy person if you are constantly sleep deprived. And so how can you set that up to sleep better? How, what about the food that you're putting? I mean, we laugh a lot, you want good test scores, put broccoli in your body, not Doritos, right?
I think of, so I have a background in recreation and then I was student affairs. So I'm used to kind of being the fluff. Right. I have an EdD and I have a PhD. I think now is the time to tie with our health promotion department and people. There is a wellness wheel and there are researched evidence-based things that we can be doing and we can partner with people who are experts in that. But I think across the board, much more training, preparation, talking through scenarios, that's what helps build confidence and kind of a, hey, I practiced this. And at first, it might be uncomfortable, but this is why I switched to social work, is because I wanted to get in and learn and do and see that how that process works. And once you start doing it, it's okay. Another topic that I see here that Amanda shared is we have BIT committees, we have care teams, we have conduct, I think, is another thing to think through. I think care teams are a great way to start some of this work, but again, we can't get into this place where, oh, this one committee is going to handle this for the whole campus. How do we really spread mental health literacy across the campus, trauma-informed care across the campus, and being able to talk to people about what this looks like? Perhaps in office hours, I'm not talking about the topic we're teaching right now. I'm talking about how you're doing as a person. And again, I think there's a lot of fear in that these people are negative, but wanting to help shift the conversation to these people are great students at the same time. They just have some things going on and we can handle it, but we might want to have some training and some policies in place, and referring to some of these areas on campus that are already in the research and know some of these things. And you can collaborate across many layers. I took a counselor and did a training for the athletes. Because they were really experiencing some things coming back from COVID. And then on top of that additional layer is they were having a lot of eating disorders and athletics. And I'm the director of student engagement, but I was invited to talk to them because this is my research. And so it's just kind of figuring out where the points are. I think orientation is a really big time to to welcome people, to help them feel safe to start some of those things. And it has to be more than a resource fair. So how are we embedding mental health literacy across campus? I started a mental health campaign on my last campus called You Matter. I tied with our faculty training department, the counseling center, disability resource center, BIT, CARES, all of those teams, and with a professor who teaches positive psychology, who did some really cool things about stress. I worked on a STEM campus where students were stressed and didn't sleep and, you know, things like that. And just kind of helping people figure out what works for you. How are you your best? Because that's going to help them when they graduate to be great workers, to be great leaders in their community, all of the things that are in our mission statements.
I want to point out, Ariana's made a comment that she's currently reading The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt. This has gotten, it is all over my Instagram feed. And I have three children who are part of the anxious generation, but that it sheds a lot of light on how it kind of basically, I think, and Ariana, feel free to correct me, but kind of the take on it is that, you know, the iPhone and all the social media and how is that rewiring our younger kids, this Gen Z, and that potentially it's setting them up for, to use her words, intense mental health issues. And so, you know, I think what I love seeing in our chat and what I really appreciate that Emily is sharing is this institutional collaboration that can really make such a difference, not only for our students, but I don't want to neglect our faculty and staff, right? Like that is, you know, it is your teams that are leading these charges on our institutions, and you all need all the support as well too. So
And I think, and that's what I'm hoping my work can be in the future is helping campuses feel prepared and talk through what is our strategy and what are some things we should be doing and thinking through all constituent groups. We want you to feel confident. We want you to feel like you have the skills to have some of these conversations, and it's a shift and it might take some time, but I think that any baby step you can do is ultimately going to be helpful. And that we'll get there as an industry, but it does take a shift, and it does perhaps change the role that people. Well, I'm faculty. I didn't sign up for this, right?
Right. Yeah. It really is. You know, it. I finished graduate school, I think 23 years ago now, and our final exercise was a group paper where we had to invent an institution. And what was fascinating was that we chose the wellness wheel to as the foundation for building an institution. And I feel like 22 years later, you know, we've kind of come full circle and we're having these conversations finally in ways that I think are actually going to be able to make change happen within our campus communities. And I'm reminded that we're never to make perfection the enemy of the good, right? Like, you said baby steps, right? Like what can we do? What's one thing we can do now? And then let's grow on to it.
It can be overwhelming. And again, you can feel like the weight of the world is on your shoulders. And if you think about suicide, oh my gosh, that's lives. But at the end of the day, there are processes for that. And I think if you collaborate, I think, so Jenny asked like what was in the mental health campaign I organized. So that included lots of different layers. So there were specific events for students, training for students, how to help a friend, how to reduce stress, stress management workshops, faculty trainings, stickers, visual passive campaign that says you matter, because we know that marginality and mattering, I'm kind of tying in my head when I'm thinking of this marginality and mattering and the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy. So you need to fill this, but you also need that bottom of that pyramid. And if you have a history of not feeling safe, are you able to engage in learning and engage in campus the way that you really want to? And how can we help to identify what those things are that are coming up for people that aren't feeling safe on campus, or who aren't connecting to each other, and helping them to do that on campus?
This is Thank you for sharing that. I mean, you think about all the different ways, and I love that it incorporated so many things. Some of our previous podcasts, we've talked about this idea of marginality and mattering. And Amanda, I'm really sorry about at your campus that, to have a shooting, and I would think that it would take decades to heal from that kind of. I mean, if you look at Kent State, that's been 50 years, and I think they're still healing from the trauma of that shooting incident on campus. Ophelia, we've got time for one more question. Ophelia asked, the bottom of the pyramid, does it need to revert back to fundamentals?
I think it's really being out there with students and listening to what they're saying, and it's the safety part of the pyramid and basic needs. So we know, like you mentioned earlier, we have students who are housing insecure. I live in an area where rent has gotten so high that I don't know how people are doing it, right? I know when I lived in the Bay Area, we certainly had a lot of students who lived in their car. And so those are all kinds of things to think about, and they all tie in. Excuse me. And so it's thinking through what are the barriers and what are the safety issues that you're seeing on your particular campus with your students. And there could be multiple, but starting from there and taking fleshing those out, right? So here we know this is a barrier. What are we doing to either coach around that for people, resolve it if we can, or to kind of be aware of it and start to work to address it if we can't remove it. And I think just kind of it takes time, but taking a step back and thinking through a lens of the campus and students and what's coming up for them. And it could be, yeah, we had this trauma on our campus and people are having a hard time. And so looking at those things about connection, starting with those little things like stress management, wellness wheel, spirituality, all those things that can be protective factors for the students and for staff. Because, yeah, you got to be able to. I have had to learn from doing the work I do now to working on a suicide crisis line. How do I, at the end of the day, just be Emily and not be thinking about this person online that told me something hard or the kid that I worked with last night who wanted to stab themselves, you know? And I have had to learn how to do that. And I think there needs to be some support for faculty and staff. Also, we know in student affairs in these places that people are working three people's jobs and they joke about it. But student affairs is in a hard place and higher education is in a hard place too. And so, what are the ways that we get together and support each other as well? Because all of those layers are important for everyone to be really able to help each other.
Well, Emily, we have gone over a few minutes. I apologize, but it was such rich conversation. We probably could keep going. I do, Jenny pointed out, saved a comment for us, a resource here about You Matter Marathon. I love that. So please check out that resource. I love it when folks share their what's working for their institutions too. Crystal's put the survey link for us today. Please do take a moment just to fill that out because it helps us. Emily, we brought you in because there was a request to do more content around trauma-informed care. So, and I would say this pairs nicely with some previous content we've done on this podcast. Like I mentioned, basic needs insecurity. We've talked about marginality and mattering in our institutions as well. So always appreciate your good work, Emily. You're doing such important work in the community and helping educate us. So thank you for your time today. It's a real gift, all of
Thank you
that.
for inviting me.
So as a reminder, this is a podcast, so it will be available on all podcasting channels. I think we pair nicely with a good walk or a cup of tea. And feel free to share this recording with others in your community. And as a reminder to everyone, today is Friday. I hope there is time for rest and renewal in your weekend ahead. So thanks, everybody, and see you next month. Thanks, everybody. Thank you, Emily.
Friday Five Live is brought to you by Innovative Educators. Innovative Educators offers six online services for your onboarding support and training needs. Visit us at innovativeeducators.org to see how we can support your student success initiatives.